economics. Not sure of that. Trevor.
Thank you, Ray. And I do want to apologize to people who are cramped up. And we always try to get to the room next door. And I'm afraid this week we were unsuccessful. But we will be trying to do something about that for future. I wanted to tell you that we have a moderators meeting tonight, a SAGPA moderators meeting. We haven't had one for 3 or 4 years. And moderators are really the backbone of SAGPA. It's not just those on the executive that put the programs together. It's our moderators. And so we're having a meeting in the room next door just for an hour from 7 until 8 o'clock. There'll be coffee and cookies. Those people that are moderating this year for, that's 2008-2009 for SAGPA, will have received emails on this, apart from Einard, but he's coming along anyway. So please do come. And for any of you that are not moderators, you're most welcome to come. That's 7 to 8 p.m. this evening in the room next door. Thank you.
So we're just continue to serve the dinner, and if you have a question and someone would like to start it out and would like to come to the microphone, I think Mr. Ed Bardock is our first guest. Ed?
Thank you for a talk from an economist that people can understand. Thank you very much. With the attempts for bailouts, particularly, for example, the car manufacturer, do you believe that the Canadian and American government should go for bailouts, or should they allow those organizations to go into bankruptcy and restructure? Because it'll be an endless lineup.
Oh boy, that's a difficult question. Partly difficult because I'm not an expert on the auto industry. So, I mean, one question I would, you know, I am in a position where I'd want to know more about how the auto firms are proposing to use that money, and are they going to repay it within a year? You know, what's the terms? But what I can speak about is the bank bailout, which certainly is not terribly popular in the United States. And so, I mean, I think legitimate questions have been asked about whether, well, maybe I can put it more broadly, why do you need to bail out banks every time they get in a crisis? Because it is a cyclical thing. And why don't you bail out other firms and make mistakes? And I think that's a genuine question, and I think it's a good question. There's something that's distinctive. I mean, I'll give you the defense, and then I'll give you the counter case. The defense about why you should bail out banks is that anyone involved in the financial sector, especially the banking sector, you're really involved in a sector which, in a way, is serving a public good. Like, it's, you know, the car sector, well, we do all drive cars, it's true, but we all rely on money for the rest of the economy to function. And so it is a distinctive sector, and it's why the financial sector has always been the most regulated sector of the economy. It's regulated because it serves these broader public functions, and so needs to be treated differently. Now, having said that, that's why, in my mind, it's particularly dangerous to allow the financial sector to get too unregulated. Because every time that seems to happen, we end up in these crises where we have to bail them out, and then we re-regulate them, and you get this kind of cycle going on. And a lot of this crisis was about a failure of regulation. And you have to blame the regulators partly for that. And one of the consequences is that you have to step in and clean up the mess. If you don't clean it up, you know, you do have systemic meltdowns. And that has consequences for everybody in a way that we don't want. Now, having said that, did the Americans do the right thing? There's bailouts and there's bailouts. What Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, originally proposed was not the right approach. You know, what he was proposing to do was to use the $700 billion to go and literally buy these toxic assets. These assets which were not worth very much money. And that was a nutty idea in my mind. Partly because it was very hard to know how to value them. Now you're going to have the government going in and buying specific subprime mortgages, trying to put a price on them, and trying to decide which one they should buy and which one they shouldn't buy. I mean, it was a mess. And I think, happily, Paulson has now moved away from that idea to a much simpler idea, which is you give the banks some capital and let them sort out their own mess. You know, so you're not micromanaging. I don't think the government is generally good at micromanaging things. It should go in with general principles, and in this case it went in with general principles and is saying, we'll give you some capital to get you in a situation where you're not risking some insolvency. So that's a long answer to say that I do think there's something different about the banking system vis-a-vis the car industry. And that the banking system is more systemically important, and that's why we bail it out. We do it every generation, it seems like. It would be nice, by the way, as a side note, that one of the proposals that's being debated right now is if in fact we're always going to end up bailing out banks when they make mistakes, wouldn't it be better to force them to pay some insurance in the good time that actually becomes the fund that does the bailouts? I actually think this is a great idea. I think we may see some kind of initiative of this kind in the next year or so that institutions, you know, the taxpayers don't have to come up and be bearing the burden each time. Now, having said that, in some ways the taxpayers aren't bearing the burden in the United States because a lot of these loans will get paid off, and it's even conceivable that the U.S. government makes money off of this situation. But it still looks bad, and it opens up exactly the question you've asked. You know, if I were a congressperson from Detroit, you know, I'd be asking, why does Wall Street get bailout and not my constituents in Detroit? And that's the kind of question that comes up when you have these bailouts. So it's a problem.
Thanks, Eric. I think we had our first agreement on public policy. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Howard Forsyth from McGrath.
That's okay.
I've almost finished reading Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine. I think the best metaphor I can refer to is, suppose there was a room full of rattlesnakes, and people sat around eating dinner, and someone was giving a children's story about angleworms. I can't believe that an educated professor from a Canadian university, in the face of what Naomi Klein says, the conclusions of which would be that Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney should be brought before the Supreme Court as war criminals. If we could just read the one chapter on how the Iraq War was designed to do the same thing, to produce the same damage that Milton Friedman's people out of Chicago's economic school, plus the IMF, which is a vicious organization, did to Bolivia and Chile, Argentina, Poland, Russia, and then tried to do with the Iraq War.
Great. Thanks. for the question.
I think this is a really important point. I mean, the IMF's reputation in the world is in tatters. You know, they had a set of gross policy errors, and it goes back quite some time. But most recently in the East Asian crisis, where they gave... I mean, it's, let me put it very strikingly. What the IMF told East Asian countries to do a decade ago is exactly the opposite of what Western countries have been doing in this financial crisis. Remember, they went into East Asia and they said, you must raise interest rates, you cannot bail out any firms, certainly don't do any nationalizations, liberalize everything that you can. And when you look at when the financial crisis then came to the U.S., you know, they did exactly the opposite of everything that was preached. So if you are in East Asia, you look at that organization and say, this is a U.S.-controlled organization with an ideological agenda, which was a kind of a free market agenda. And this is the legitimacy crisis that the IMF has. And I think can only be solved by having some dramatic governance restructuring. So that you say to China and you say to South Korea, you know, this organization is not what it was because you now have a major seat at the table. You have some voice in that organization. Until that happens, I don't think you're going to get countries lining up to borrow from this. And this is one of the reasons why East Asian countries are lending to each other. And they're saying, we don't need to go through this organization with the track record of that kind. So it's a serious situation. I think the other thing that your comments made me think about is in these regulatory debates, we do have a basic split between the American and British position, which is more of the kind you're describing it, more of a Milton Friedman style, you know, less regulation is better. Vis-a-vis the German, the French, and most of the developing world, which is asking for tighter regulations. And one of the things that is a possible consequence over the next year or so is that you had this G20 meeting, you had everyone at the table, and everyone agreed in principle that there needs to be regulation of the banks and regulation of credit rating agencies, etc. But when you get into the detailed negotiations, you're going to have very deep splits on this question of how much regulation. And if those splits are too severe, I think you will get more of this kind of decentralized pressure. So Europe will simply go its own way. And the Germans and the French, you know, they now control one of the major currencies in the world, the euro, and with very large integrated markets. And if they want to regulate some of these things on their own terms, they can do it unilaterally. And some of those terms set international, so I'll give you an example. In the accounting field, for a very long time, American accounting rules were the most important rules. Last year, the Americans have agreed to adopt European accounting rules, and it's because of the power of the euro and the power of European financial markets. And so that's a kind of a shift in power, which can either be resolved through international negotiations where you come to a consensus, or it can be resolved through the Europeans going their own way and a kind of a decentralized pressure. And the same is true in East Asia. East Asian countries in April of this year have decided to set up something called the Asian Financial Stability Forum, which is a regional spin-off of what is a larger group called the Financial Stability Forum, which involves all major rich countries. And everyone kind of scratched their head. Why would you do that? You know, there's already a Financial Stability Forum, of which you're a member, and why do you need your own? And I think it's the sense in which they're keeping their options open. You know, if the Americans and the British continue to resist regulation, they can go their own way.
There are no vicious motives.
Mr. Forsyth.
There are no vicious motives.
Mr. Forsyth, could I have you, could I just have you go in rotation and come back again? Because there's two gentlemen behind you, and I'd like to, our time is very short, and I want to make sure everybody gets a chance.
So. I think we've been listening to something for children. I'm about to vomit. I can't stand this.
Okay, thank you. No, I appreciate your free expression. Sir?
Al Barnhill. I'm not a big fan of the economists. I've been in
joint departments of economics and commerce and so forth in various universities, and appreciate your theories. But I think that a lot of the problem as exists now is very well crystallized in Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations, and I don't see any mechanistic way, whether it's regulations or whether you're trying to change the market system or whatever, it's just not going to happen. And that book really, really crystallizes the problems. American, United States model is passé. It's morally corrupt, it's socially corrupt, it's economically corrupt, and it's not going to succeed. And it's the last gasp now. You know, Bush has been the ultimate morally and politically corrupt person. So, you know, we have to look elsewhere. Where would you look beyond just the mechanisms of economics and financial controls and systems and processes?
Good, thanks.
You're welcome.
I think that crystallizes one scenario, which is this kind of decentralized future, where you get East Asian countries saying, you know, we have a distinctive political economy, distinctive traditions, we have our own set of preferences about how to respond to this crisis. The continental Europeans have their own, and many in Latin America, they're very actively involved in regional integration as well. So I think you could see a scenario which everyone goes their own way according to historical traditions that are distinctive to their regions. And that's not necessarily a bad scenario, but it's different than what we've had for the last decade, which is an attempt to build up these universal standards, but largely on American-British, you know, models. That's been the model. And that model, in the financial sector at least, has been discredited by this crisis. And so if the Americans and British can't come out of that process with some new vision, then I think you'll get regions going their own way.
My name is James Moore. I have a comment and then a question. The comment is the good thing about this financial crisis is it's wonderful for the environment. And I think that, having made that comment, the relationship is one that we've been missing between the economy and the environment, and we do that at our peril. My question is more, when we see the creators of the problem, and I give you, for instance, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which separated the investment from the retail banking and gave them the right to gamble with the public money. When we see the push for deregulation into Canada with 40-year zero down payment mortgages, which was on its way here and which could be accelerated by Chapter 11 of NAFTA, when we see that entire structure of deregulation pushed by all of these bankers, how is it possible that you turn around and give the creators of the problem that they're the ones that are going to find the solution? It's impossible. The creators of the problem cannot find the solution. There needs to be an alternative, and my question is this. A specific example of what I'm talking about. The Canadian government, at the bequest of the banks, tripled their investment from $25 to $75 billion into the mortgages that the banks choose them to buy. For those $75 billion, if you're looking for a creative solution rather than same old, same old, at this morning's evaluations, market capitalization, for $75 billion, we could buy the Bank of Commerce, the Bank of Nova Scotia, and the Bank of Montreal, and have $5 billion left to do the Kelowna Accord, and we know that the poor people are the ones that ship it all through, and $1 billion in change. So why can't we look for these creative solutions rather than the same old?
It comes back to this question of what is the role of banks in society, and you know, they perform in theory some public good role. You know, everybody needs credit. The whole economy is governed by credit. And my view is that banks, you need to think about banks in that kind of public good role. But if you don't regulate them to make sure they serve that role, then it's you've lost the purpose of that principle. And I think that's a situation that that especially the Americans got into in their context. I want to come back to your first point, though, about the link between financial markets and environmental issues. This is something which was not discussed at all in Washington, which is bizarre. I mean, here we're experiencing multiple crises. You'd think we'd look for interactions between them. And there are clear interactions. For example, the role that the financial crisis played in triggering the global food crisis. There's a relationship between those things, and yet there's no discussion of that going on. Why is that? I think it's because the politics of financial regulation has been governed by very technocratic people. So this goes back to your skepticism about economists. And it's a certain specialization even within economics that tends to dominate these things because they're seen as so abstractly technical. And it's not been until very recently that the environmental movement's gotten interested. Now, they got very interested in trade and environment issues and all kinds of debates about, Chapter 11 environmental issues. But the link, have you seen the major environmental NGOs in the world lobbying, about global financial flows or about accounting rules or about how you regulate bond rating agencies? All of those things have massive environmental consequences, but we haven't seen the links being made. And one of the things that I'm working on with a PhD student right now is to try to begin to get those links made. I mean, if we're rewriting the rules about how we regulate accounting, there's massive consequences if you pick fair value accounting versus historic cost accounting for the environment. And yet nobody's making that link. We're trying to begin to do that. And I really hope that the NGO sector increasingly gets interested in this issue. And there's some evidence, I've been talking to some environmental NGOs who are getting interested in this. They see the consequences and they're trying to make the links.
Ruth Elzinga.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you for for being here today. This must be a difficult time for Barack Obama to be president-elect. You made mention of the fact that in 3 weeks they were able to organize a G20. It takes longer to plan a family reunion. I'm just curious. This is putting politics into the mix, knowing that Bush has not been respected and America's got a black eye throughout the world. Do you think that the fact that we have someone who's open-minded, fresh face, intelligent, incoming president, relative to some of the things that have to be changed, i.e. the IMF, etc., that there's more willingness to come together? And I'm just curious.
Well, we don't, it all comes down to who's advising Obama on some of these things. So you want to know who the key officials are, and we still don't know that. We don't know who the Treasury Secretary is going to be. And once that choice is made, then you see who the person doing international within the Treasury is. And so that's going to be a key thing to look for. We do know that Obama's team was being apprised of the negotiations before the G20 meeting very closely. So this was, although he didn't turn up to meetings, he was being consulted by the Bush administration at every step of the way. And that's encouraging in one way, but I also found it a little bit discouraging because the U.S. position at the meeting they weren't as ambitious as I think is needed at this moment. They were sort of saying, oh, there's some problems, but we can tinker with these following things. And so when I heard that the Obama people had been consulted directly, I thought, well, does that mean Obama is not seeing the financial crisis as a moment to do something dramatic in the regulatory realm? And so that may be the case. I think with respect to IMF reform, he's more of a multilateralist. If it comes down to, needing some dramatic governance changes to try to move the IMF away from its history, which is really discredited as an institution, I think he's going to be more inclined to do that. But I would add that it's the Europeans that are more the problem there. The Europeans have to give up their seats. And the U.S. actually has less voting rules, less voting power than they're supposed to under the rules they've given up. So it's the Europeans that are the problem. So I find it very difficult to see President Sarkozy and Gordon Brown making these strong appeals for reform, but they've actually been blocking IMF reform throughout this time. So they're speaking out of both sides of their mouth.
Thanks. We have about 3 minutes left, and there's two ways we could approach that. One, we'll take this question, and then possibly another question. But at that point, if the meeting feels we need another question or 5 minutes, I'll take a little vote. But if people have to leave, then we've got to honor that commitment.
Okay, right to my question. It follows on Ruth's Obama question, because I was going to introduce it with Obama first as well. Obama got a long way in stating it should be a solution not just for Wall Street, but for Main Street. Mm. I want to know about the back street.
Yeah.
And what about on the street? Like, I really think that if this continues, people are going to be on the street. Is it going to be the dirty 30s again? And did the solutions get anywhere near to... you're going to prevent it from the future.
Yeah.
But what's happening for the now,
yeah,
the people are going to be on the street.
Yeah, exactly. And one, I meant to mention in a previous comment that one worrying thing is, both U.S. political parties are heavily financed by Wall Street, and so it does constrain their ability to do dramatic things. So that's a kind of general comment about Obama. But I think you're right that just to take the bailout as an example, he's been saying that so you should be recapitalizing banks, but you should also be doing some direct targeted support of people who are in a situation of losing their homes. And so that's the kind of where you're trying to combine, supporting Wall Street and the industry. But when it comes to the, is there some parallel to the 1930s? I mean, this is where I think Obama's healthcare plan is vitally important. Here we have the one rich country in the world which does not have comprehensive health care. And so when people lose their job, they lose a lot more than that. And so if he can introduce some kind of sense of social security at a time which is going to have large-scale unemployment, I presume, that's, I think, a useful step. So then, to come back to the employment question, in the Great Depression, unemployment rates went very, very high. I don't think we're going to see, the kind of rates that we saw at that time period. But it will rise. What we learned in the Great Depression is Keynesian economics, which is when you get trouble, you run deficits. And the government steps in as the kind of consumer of last resort, if you like. And despite all the talk about Keynes being dead and the Milton Friedman intellectual revolution, almost everybody is still a Keynesian, in agreeing with that basic principle that when crises happen, there is a role for government to step in. And that was Keynes's innovation. So I think you'll see that with the Obama people. The Obama people, if you look at who the people are who are likely to become Treasury Secretary, they're all very committed to that kind of vision of counter-cyclical government spending, which just wasn't there in the 30s. If you look at Hoover, what did Hoover do? Markets must clear, was his response. And what did that mean? That meant people have, unemployment has to get so high that wages begin to fall gradually. Now, that was his solution. That was a free market solution. And I don't think anybody is in the position of calling for that in the Obama team.
Last question until I get further notice as chair.
Dwayne Pendergast, James Moore brought up an interesting point in connection with the environment and the economy. I think maybe he might be coming to the wrong conclusion, because I would think this could bring environmental disaster too. You mentioned that the Europeans are controlling the IMF. They certainly controlled the development of the Kyoto Protocol, sold Canada a wooden nickel on that thing. Do you think the Europeans might have brought this about to try and make the Kyoto Protocol come true?
I'm not an expert in that, so I don't know. But I don't think they brought it on. If I can say one thing about the Europeans, the Europeans have come out of this crisis in a terrible state. The circumstance of watching them scramble to try to bail out their banks was an embarrassment. This is supposed to be a monetary union, with common collective agreements, and it just was a disaster. The Irish go their way, French go their way, and it came to a point at one moment where people were openly saying, can the euro survive as a common currency? So this has not been a good crisis for European cooperation.
Good. So I'd like to thank everybody for their attendance today. We'd certainly like to thank Dr. Helliner for his comments and expertise and sharing his time with us. Please give him a good round of applause. The next... The meeting next week, I was asked to make note of what your agenda is for next week. Sorry about that. Just give me a little bit of help. Here we are. So the topic for next week is, will Lethbridge's most vulnerable seniors soon be at risk? The speaker is going to be David Egan, and David is the executive director of the Friends of Medicare. The moderator for next week is Susan Giffen, and lunch will be as served this week. So thank you very much for being in attendance, and we appreciate being able to come here to be with you today. Thank you.